Morning. It's good to be here with you. When I got my eighth grade schedule, I was less than pleased because I noticed that when I got my schedule that my homeroom teacher was a guy named Mr. Cordell. And my brother had gone through this school a few years earlier, and I knew by reputation that Mr. Cordell was a very strict teacher. And if you were the kind of kid that I was, that was not good news. And so I came in and I got into Mr. Cordell's room and I was really nervous. But for some reason, even though he was a really strict teacher, we kind of got along. And we kind of got this bond together, and we kind of had this thing that we were going, and we became really good friends, and we would joke back and forth. And this strict teacher, it went really well for me. But if like a hallmark of my childhood is that I took things way too far, right? And so I eventually did that with Mr. Cordell. One day, we were in the midst of it, and this relationship that we had got, we were bantering back and forth, and we were joking back and forth. And all of a sudden, Mr. Cordell said, "Brent, cool it." He goes, "Quit smarting off." And then, you know, taking it too far, I said, "I'll quit smarting off when you quit being a jerk." Oh, the second those words came out of my mouth, I was trying to get them back in, right? And he immediately goes, "That's a 500-word theme of why to respect your teacher." And I said, "But," and he goes, "1,000. And I went. And so to understand kind of why that was such a big deal, you got to understand the culture I grew up in. When I was in fifth grade, my teacher, Mrs. Croy, you had a 3 strikes and you're out limit. If in 3 times in 1 week you did not say ma'am when you addressed her, 3 times in 1 week you would go to the hall and get paddling, corporal punishment. The culture I grew up in, you respected your elders and you said yes, ma'am, and yes, sir, and if you didn't. And so when I said that to Mr. Cordell, it wasn't a good thing, right? And I knew it immediately. And immediately I was like, "Oh, I blew it." And as a kid, at that moment, you knew, "Oh, that's way too far, Brent. I deserve that." And I wrote my 1,000-word theme on how to respect my teacher. It was hard. As an eighth grader, that's a lot of words. I think I made up some blah, blah, blahs in the middle of it, but I did my best. But here's the thing. As a kid who always got in trouble, I understood why Mr. Cordell, I was in trouble. That I went way too far. But for the most part, I never understood why I was in trouble because I was always talking in class, right? And I always got in trouble in class. The teachers would say, "Brent, you got to sit down in your chairs." I'd be like, "What's the big deal?" I remember one time I would always get up. I would always talk. I was always taking things too far. And I never understood why I got in so much trouble, right? I never understood why they were sending me to the principal's office. I remember one time, I was like, "It's not that big of a deal. I'm just talking and moving. I have a tough time sitting still." One time in fourth grade, they sent home a deficiency slip. You know what a deficiency slip is? It's like when you're making a D or an F in a subject midterm, they would send a letter home to your parents. They had to sign it. I got a deficiency slip in behavior, right? It's like, why? Like, I wasn't being mean. I wasn't stealing stuff. I was just kind of being me. What's the big deal? And I bet you can feel that way too, right? There's things in your life where you've blown it. You cheated. You lied to your parents and snuck out. There was something you've done in your life that you're going, "Yeah, I got busted and I really deserved it," right? I deserved the judgment that I got. But then most of the time, if you're honest, with your boss, at work, different grades, different people you've interacted with, you're like, "Really? It's not that big of a deal. Like, why is everybody freaking out? What's going on? It's not that big of a deal. I just got a little louder. I just went a little too far. What's the big deal?" And so this morning, we're going to kind of come into the scriptures. And this question is a question we ask often all the time. And so when we come to God, we ask the same questions a lot. There's things that we're like, "Yeah, that deserved judgment." But then other times when we walk in and we interact with God, we're like, "Why, God, why is this such a big deal of the way that I do this? Why do you care so much?" And so you got to remember where we're at. Last week we opened the scriptures and we looked at Genesis, all of creation. And we looked at how God made this very good earth and everything was perfect. Everything was going the way it was, but humanity made a horrible choice. And when they ate the fruit, sin entered in not just to Adam and Eve, but all throughout humanity, infected all of humanity with this sin. And so we saw that this garden was good and God called it good and everything was beautiful. But then in the end of our time last week, we saw that sin entered in. And so the question that we're going to ask this morning is, what happens to the world when sin enters in? Because God made a beautiful, everything was perfect world, but now sin has entered in, and we're going to open the text this morning and find out what exactly happens when sin enters in. And it's actually worse than we can imagine. Let's pick it up in Genesis chapter 4. We come up, and our first characters are Cain and Abel. Abel is a shepherd. Abel, he shepherds a bunch of flocks, and Cain is a worker of the ground. He's a farmer. And so what happens is in the course of time, Cain and Abel come and they give an offering before God. And what happens is Abel brings his offering, and he brings his the first of his sheep, and he offers and he sacrifices this lamb before God. And Cain comes, and he's a farmer, so what does he do? He brings what he has. He brings his fruit, and he puts it before God. And the scripture says that God had no regard for Cain's sacrifice, but that he liked Abel's sacrifice. We're like, what's the deal? Why is this happening? And why did he not like Cain's? And there's a number of reasons people have hypothesized all over the place. Maybe it's because it wasn't a blood sacrifice, and only blood sacrifices can cover for sin. And that might be true, but I think we get a picture of what's going in chapter 4, verse 7. This is what God says to Cain. If you do well, will you not be accepted? Because he just told him, I don't accept your sacrifice. And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at your door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. And here's what he's saying. He's saying, listen, if you do well, I'll accept it. And it's almost like God's saying, listen, if your life was consistent with the sacrifice you were given, then I would have accepted it. But your life is so far removed from the way that I want you to live. And he disregards it. And what happens? Cain gets super jealous. And when Abel's out in the fields with his flocks, Cain sneaks up on him and murders him. The first 10 verses after we've seen sin come in, we see how bad sin really is. Murder. The very first step, it's murder. Sin has infected humanity, and it's worse than we can imagine. There's further fallout. There's a downward spiral. There's murder. That's really starting pretty low, but it actually gets worse. They go through and they say all of Cain's descendants. And then we come to a guy named Lamech. And Lamech has two wives, which is already against the way God designed it. And his wife, here's what he does. In all of his wives, he brags to them. Do you want to know what he brags about? This is in verse 23 of chapter 4. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Listen to what I say. Listen to what he's bragging about, church. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, if Cain is revenging Abel sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. And he's bragging at being 11 times worse than Cain. It just downward spirals. And it's going from bad to worse. It's murder, and now it's the descendants, and they're murdering. And he's bragging about murder. He's not even hiding in it. This downward spiral is going downhill really quickly. And so maybe there's a new hope, because chapter 5 comes, and Adam and Eve said, listen, Cain, Abel is good. He was good, but he's dead. And now Cain's line, they're absolutely horrible. Maybe if we start a new son and a new line, it'll be better. And he goes through, and Seth is born, Adam and Eve. And it goes through, and in that list of all of his descendants, we see something that maybe some good news. There's a guy named Enoch. And Enoch in verse 24, Enoch walked with God and he was not, for God took him. And as we look through there, Enoch walked with God so much that he kind of helped him escape the evilness of this world, and he pulled him up. And so maybe there's goodness in this line. And then Lamech, who's a new Lamech in the line of Seth, this is what the Bible says he prophesied about. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he fathered a son. This is verse 28, verse 29. And called his name Noah, saying, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. And now, out of the line of Seth, we see maybe some godliness with Enoch. And then the new Lamech says, and there's going to be Noah. And that verse, in verse 29, he says that there's going to be relief. And in the original language, if you can look, that word relief is almost exactly the way that the word Noah is. And he's saying, there's a new son in our line, and his name's Noah, and he's going to give us relief. And so now we have Noah. Noah's on the scene. And so maybe there's hope. There's this godly line with Seth. Maybe there's hope, but here's the situation. Chapter 6, verse 5, it doesn't look very good. The Lord saw that wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Oh man, I thought we were going to get out of this with Noah, but this is what the people are like. And there's wickedness in all of humanity, and every intention of his heart is evil. And then verse 11 continues it going, chapter 6. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. So even with Noah, who was supposed to bring relief, humanity just keeps spiraling out of control. So what's God's decision? This is an interesting verse. This is probably one of the more interesting verses I've read recently that just makes me go, oh man. Chapter 6, verse 6. And the Lord regretted that he made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. Humanity is so bad that God in heaven regrets it. I remember when we had kids, and the amount of sleep that I've lost and money I've lost because of kids is really high, right? You just take the price of diapers with three kids. I could have bought a car, right? But I've never regretted, no matter how many times my kids have screamed and cried and thrown fits, I've never regretted. There might have been a few moments in the middle of the night when they're really little bitty, right? But I've never regretted my children. And God is saying, I regret humanity because they're so out of control. And what does he do? Verse 13, and God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence, and through them, behold, I will destroy them with the earth. God regrets it, and he says, it's done. I'm through. So what happens? He tells Noah to build an ark, and he destroys all flesh. Listen to this verse, and this is 6:17. For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, in which the breath of life, in which is the breath of life under heaven. Do you see it? The very life that God breathed his life into last week, and it was good, he's destroying this week. Because sin just keeps spiraling out of control. So what happens? He builds an ark. A few details about this ark. This ark is 510 feet long. That's 1.5 football fields, in case you're wondering. It's football season, so all the guys know what I'm talking about. It's taller than a four-story building. Its storage capacity inside this ark, it could hold 500 semi-trailers of cargo. That's how big the ark was. In fact, the way that the people that I read calculated, they could put 120,000 sheep in this thing. And so the question that you should be asking, is this even possible, right? Like, this seems a little far-fetched, an ark that big in those prehistoric times. That seems a little ridiculous, and I agree. But however, in history, there's ships that have rivaled this. There's a ship called the Zhonghe in China, which is a merchant trading ship. And it was, depending on the literature you read, it was between 400 and 600 feet, right there in the realm of what we're dealing with. There were also some Greek ships that they paddled outside of that were rumored, and that there's some sort of academic research that say, yeah, there's a ship that's been that big. And so what's on the ship? All of creation. He brings one pair of every animals and seven pairs of every clean animals. And so you should probably be asking yourself, what's a clean animal? The clean animals are actually the animals that were for sacrifice, because God knew that there was still going to be sin and there was still going to be need to be sacrificed. And so he provided the provision so that those animals could be sacrificed to pay for sin, even on the thing, even on the ship. Who's on the ship? Noah, his three sons, and their wives. There's eight total people on the ship. How long were they on the ship? 370 days according to a lunar calendar, because the Hebrews followed a lunar instead of the calendar that we follow. And so here's the reality. That's just a few things, and it's really crazy how fast we have to go through some of this with this new series. But let's get the reality of the ark, because I don't know about you, but when I think of the ark, I immediately think of a couple of songs. Who built the ark? Noah, right? I saw you. You're Noah, you know it. And there's another song, so it's a fun kids song, right? The other song is, the Lord taught Noah to build him and, right? You know it. And so as a kid, we learn these fun, silly songs. And I remember the flannel graphs by Miss Joy in my church showing us building this ark. And it seems like this fun story. And then this story ends with a rainbow and there's so much hope. God's never going to flood the story again. And it seems like a really cute kid story. But can I tell you what's really happening? It's not a cute story at all. Thousands and most likely millions of people died. Dead. Except for eight. And it shouldn't be called Noah and the Ark. It should be called the single deadliest day in the history of all humanity. Because when the floods came, millions of people are dead. Do you catch that? Do you get that in your brain? This isn't a cute story with animals coming on the ship. This is a story of millions of people dying because sin has infected humanity and they continue to choose horribleness no matter what they're doing. And God destroys the people. Can you imagine it? Can you imagine? Because we've seen stories of like when Katrina hit. Do you remember how we saw this flood in the lower wards of New Orleans? And people were trying to get out. Or we see news crew films showing when there's a river and some dummy. Don't drive into running water, by the way. Don't be that guy. But someone inevitably is going to drive into running water. And the fire department has to get out and they save them off the roof of their car. And we see it. But that day there was no one saved. Everyone was crawling to the top of their roofs. Everyone was crawling to the tops of the trees trying to be saved, and they're all dead, all of them, because of sin. It's so bad, God regretted making him. So I guess God takes sin seriously, doesn't he? And can I be honest? This is kind of hard to stomach, isn't it? Like millions of people, bam, gone, you're done. That's hard to stomach. But it's maybe easier to understand. Because God created all of humanity, and it was good, and there was a good world. And what have they done? They've taken off, and they've done what they wanted. They did exactly what they wanted. They didn't do what God. They violate the way that God created the earth. And they chose their own way. They looked at God and said, we don't care. We're going to do it our way. And so when we look at this as a cosmic and a divine sense, it feels really harsh that God's killing all humanity. But if you boil this concept down to something that we deal with day in and day out, it makes a lot more sense. If you have a 16-year-old, and you give them a car. You're like, hey, out of the benevolence of your father and your mother's heart, we're going to give you a car. And then they all of a sudden start failing algebra, and they start lying about it, and they sneak out. What do? You take the car away. It's gone. And everybody understands that. Everyone in our society would be like, yeah, they don't deserve a car if they're going to act that way. Or maybe you have smaller kids, and you're like, yes, you can have some electronic time. And they go, did you clean your room? Yes, of course I clean my room, Mom and Dad. And they go in the other room, and they take some electronic time. What do? You take the iPad away. Everybody understands that. And in some sense, that's what's happening here, except this isn't a divine justice type of way. There's divine justice here. This just isn't discipline. But as a holy God, God cannot be around or entertain anything that is sinful. And his creation has not only like dabbled in sin, they've deep dived into sin, and God can no longer be around it. And sin must, the justice of God requires that sin has a penalty and it must be atoned for. And so it's hard to stomach. It really is. But it might be just a little bit easier to understand. And then if we pull back even a little bit, my hunch is this, guys, is that as we come in here and worship, we do not really want to worship a God that does not hold justice tightly. But we want to worship a God that handles justice. And if there is a break in the law, that there should be justice with it. We want a God that handles sin like that. But the good news is we can continue. He does provide a way out. So what happens after the ark? Because here we got eight people. They've survived. The rest of humanity is dead because of all their sins. So what happened? We come up after the ark, and here's what they do. The first thing they do, is maybe some good news, is they build an altar and they offer sacrifices. They step off the ark and they offer sacrifices, and God comes and speaks to Noah, and he builds a covenant with Noah. It's called the Noahic covenant, and God establishes it with Noah, and he says this: he will not destroy the earth and living creatures again by a flood. And just to remind God of this, the scripture says that God put a rainbow in the sky to remind himself in verse 16 that he would never do it again. And you're always kind of, as the reader's reading along, go, whew, that was close. I think we dodged a bullet. Everything should be on schedule now. Everything should be back. All the evil people are killed. It's good. No, because as soon as they step off the boat, they step right back into sin. He blows it. What happens? Noah becomes a man of the soil. And what does he do? He plants a vineyard. So Noah, they come off. He's got to kind of tame this land. He plants a vineyard. You know what he does with that vineyard? He takes the wine, he takes the grapes, he makes some wine, and he gets drunk. And not just kind of drunk, like, oh, I maybe should stop. He gets really drunk, like passed out and naked type of drunk. And you see Noah going right back to these pagan ways. You're like, what's going on? And then in a way that's somewhat hard for us to understand, there's this weird interaction that's really hard for us, but it gets worse than Noah's drunkenness. Ham comes into Noah's tent when he's drunk, and he sees him naked. And in the Old Testament, this being exposed naked brought incredible, incredible shame. And so that's really weird for us, and it's kind of what's going on there. But do you know what he does about that in his father's shame? He doesn't kind of try to protect it and look away. He looks at it, and then he goes and he gossips and he mocks his father to his two brothers. And his two brothers, Ham and Japheth, come in and they say, that's not right. That's not the way this thing should go down. So they actually get some cloaks. They get something to cover their father, and they walk him backwards so that they don't see what's going on because they don't want to see the nakedness, and they cover their father. And you see this picture almost exactly what like Adam and Eve when they were naked in the garden. And what did God have to do? He had to make some clothes. He had to come in and he had to cover them. And so, Noah, God has three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And Ham, God curses his line. It says your descendants will be cursed, and they're the Canaanites. And you'll hear that name come back up as we go through this thing, because the Canaanites become enemies of Israel. But Shem and Japheth, their response, they cover him, and they're all good and they're blessed. And so we hit chapter 10. And in chapter 10, we see all these descendants of Noah. And maybe, just maybe, Ham, who did something horribly shameful, is out of the picture and he's cursed. Maybe Shem and Japheth will take it care of, and they go down the list. And then in chapter 11, the scholars would say we're about 390 years later after the flood. And depending on who you, it's kind of fun when you read some guys about how many people are on earth back then, and they actually have equations for how they figured this out. And so let me give you a range. There's either between 35,000 and 920,000 people on the earth, just for a little range, right? And it depends on how you're multiplying them. Since, anyways, I could get into it, but it's nerdy. So let's just say there's hundreds of thousands of people on the earth now after Noah. 390 years later, and we find ourselves on the plains of Shinar. And all the people are speaking one language. Society is starting to get advanced. They've learned some things. And we find that the people have got this new technology. And this new technology is actually a brick. And a brick is actually very technological, because used to, they slept under a tree. They would sleep in a cave. They would try to fashion something, but all of a sudden they've got this technology called a brick, and they're like, we can make things, and actually we can burn them thoroughly, and they'll get hard, and what do they want to do? Chapter 11, verse 4, this says this. They said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower with its tops in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. Here's what they're doing. They want to build a city, a place for human flourishing, and they want to build a tower to heaven so that they can be near God. And it's almost as if, by their own strength and with their own technology, they're trying to recreate Eden. They're building a tower so they can interact with God. They're building this city so that they can flourish the way they were supposed to in Eden. And with a brick, their own technology, they're trying to do it. But there's one problem. They want to do it to make a name for themselves. And God sees the end game. Check it out in verse 6, chapter 11, verse 6. And then the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. He knows the sin in their hearts. And he knows if they're all together, that thing is just going to continue to spiral out of control, downward spiral. And we see this, like, and what does he do? He confuses their languages and he splits them up. Like, you can't do it. I'm ending your agenda and I'm breaking you up. Here's what we see, guys. Do you see how serious God takes sin? At every turn, he deals with it. And the fall has left humanity incapable of not choosing sin. Even when there was a fresh start, what did humanity do? Jumped right back into it. But then we also see this reality that God takes sin very serious. Cain murdered. He sent him out as a wanderer. All of humanity, they're dead because of their sins. Ham looked on his father in a really shameful way, and his line is cursed, and Babel, they're split. No matter what, God dealt with the sin of his people in a very swift way. If you read that, what's our reaction this morning as we hear that story? Like, what's your reaction? And there's a few things. If you're like me when I'm reading this, this is how I read it. Why couldn't they get their act together? Like, didn't you learn something when millions of people died, Noah? Shouldn't you have figured out that you should do it the way God says to do it now? Couldn't you have figured it out, Ham? You saw the millions of people. You looked over the deck of the ark and you saw millions of people die, and you still, you got off the boat and you, can't you guys figure it out? The other way I look at it is I look like, yeah, God, sometimes your judgment is really good. Because Cain killing Abel, that deserves some punishment, in my opinion. Like, I get that. That's good. But then I look at other things like Ham interacting, like looking on his father's nakedness. I don't get that because that's not cultural for us. And all of a sudden, his entire line of descendants is cursed. God, isn't that kind of radical? Couldn't we just say, hey, don't do it again, bud. Stop. And here's the thing. As we look at this whole story, those are legitimate questions. They really, really are. How do you interact it? But can I tell you the right way we should respond to this? We should be quaking in fear with the way God handles sin. We should be, oh man, that's how God sees sin? This is much worse than I thought. Because guys, we are so much closer to sin than we want to admit, right? We want to act like, oh yeah, I go to church. Oh yeah, I read the Bible. I'm pretty good. You're crazy. Your life in and of itself is in a downward spiral too. Our lives are horribly plagued with sin. In fact, I wish that we could develop a technology, and that technology is a GoPro. I guess we have the technology, and it would just sit on your chest. And for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, this last week, we just filmed your life, right? I promise you, if I said, I'm going to take that video and put it up here, and we're going to all watch it, you would begin to shrink back and go, yeah, there might be a little bit more sin than I want to admit, Brent. But then if we could develop this technology, and some of you've got that figured out, and you don't do anything outward that's really sinful because you've been a Christian a really long time and you just know kind of the game, maybe that's you. But what if we found a new technology that the camera wasn't right here seeing the real world, but there was a camera in your brain and in your thoughts and in your heart? And every thought, every way you kind of process the world, we could put up on this screen this morning. I'm pretty sure no one would volunteer for their video to be up there, right? Because if we're honest with ourselves, the sin in our lives is strong. Because the sin of a lot longer gaze at a woman that's not your wife, right? anger towards your boss. Like not just that was kind of annoying, but deep-seated anger. Gossip about your coworkers. In the break room when no one was looking, but did you hear that? That's against the scriptures. Unforgiveness to your spouse. Maybe you did legitimately have a hard season, and you had a hard patch, and for some reason you will not forgive your spouse. Maybe it's a practice of yours. It's just one drink too many. Just sneaking it by. One drink too many. Or you're using God's provision to pave a more comfortable way for yourself instead of giving the way he would. God, guys, we're just humanity. And I hope that you're honest about your ability to downward spiral in sin. This is a very scary place to be, guys. So what's our hope? What's our hope? If you feel like me and you're like, yeah, there's a lot of sin in my life and I battle it, but it's still there and God judges sin, what's the hope this morning? Well, if we look back through the story, I want to retell the story because with Cain, after Cain was judged, he goes back to God and he said, God, people are going to kill me because I've done that. And you know what God does? In verse 15 of chapter 4, he says, then the Lord said to him, not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And out of his mercy, do you know what God does? And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest anyone who found him should attack him. So even in the midst of Cain's judgment, there was a little bit of grace. He marked him so that other people would not kill him. All of humanity, yeah, millions of people are dead, but in God's mercy, he saves eight. He saves eight. And then Ham, he goes in and very dishonors his father with shame because of this altercation in the tent. But do you know what God does? He judges Ham, but he also gives the grace through the other two lines and says, I'll bless these guys even though Ham is now cursed. And at the Tower of Babel, he takes them all. He's like, guys, you're going to blow it and you're already blowing it. And so out of my mercy, I'm not going to wipe you out. Do you know what I'm going to do this time? I'm going to scatter you so you guys can't corroborate and you can't work together to get yourself into sin so that you're split out and you can't even communicate to make yourselves more sinful and keep on the downward spiral. Even in the smallest of ways, even when there was judgment, God gives grace. And we see this pattern this morning. I want you to remember this, that number one is this, you cannot shake sin. No matter what you do, you cannot shake sin. Number two, sin must be judged. Sin must be judged, but the third thing is so important, that only God gives us a way out. Only God gives us a way out, because you can't shake sin, and sin must be judged, but only God gives a way out. So today, you have to feel this, guys. You feel the weight of your sin, and we feel this like judgment is on its way, so what are we going to do? Because listen to Matthew 24. The floodwaters aren't going to hit us, but let's look at Matthew 24, 37. Just listen to me. For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Guys, we're not going to have floodwaters, but Jesus Christ will return. And what's our hope? God gives us a way out, and it's in Jesus. I love this verse in 2 Corinthians 5:21. This is what it says. For our sake, he made him, speaking of Jesus, to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Guys, you can't shake sin. And sin will be judged, but only God can provide a way out. In church, our way out is not an ark. Our way out is Jesus. Our way out is Jesus. And I hope that you feel the weight of your sin, but I also hope that you feel the hope that is in Jesus. Last night, our kids, probably just like your kids, love electronic time, right? They love being able to have a tablet and to be able to play their games and all that sort of stuff. And last night, one of our daughters tattled on Justice and said, hey, Mom, Dad, Justice, take his Kindle upstairs. And he was caught red-handed because he was going to go upstairs and play this Kindle, right? So he runs upstairs, and she comes down, and I'm working over on the side of the room, and Carrie goes, Justice, listen, I don't want to take your Kindle away. I don't want to take it away. But if your Kindle is going to cause you to sneak, which is lying, I would rather take that away from you than have you constantly wanting to lie to your mom and dad and sin. Right? They had this quick conversation. I was off on the side of the room, and I didn't think much about it. And so we're back, and I was waiting for the OU football game to start because it was weather delayed, and it did not turn out good. And so I'm sitting on the couch a few minutes later, and I don't like telling stories about my kids when I preach, but I asked his permission to tell this story this morning. And he came down the stairs, and he's upset. And he said, Dad, can I have a hammer? And I'm like, what do you want it for, son? And he says, I want to smash my Kindle. And he's kind of got tears in his eyes, and he comes down and he sits in his mama's lap. Carrie's sitting right in front of me. And it was this really tender moment. Do you want to know why? Because he knows he can't shake his desire to want to constantly be running back to that thing. And he knows that if he keeps running back to that thing, it's going to be judgment from his mom and dad. And you know what he did? He came running to his mom and dad and said, help. Help me. Do you know what's sad, church? Is as adults, we think we're beyond that, and we don't often come down the stairs and say, I need help. We don't admit that we can't shake sin. We just act like we got it together. We don't admit it. Are you kidding me? I got this figured out. I can handle my anger. I can handle my lust. It's not that big of a deal. Who cares if I gossip a little bit? And we won't even admit that we can't shake it, let alone that judgment is on its way. And if we won't even admit that we got it, do you think we run to Jesus for help through it? No. Church, I need you to tell you something this morning. On your own, you cannot shake sin. Judgment's coming, and your only hope is Jesus Christ. That's it. That's it. Your hope is not in figuring it out. Your hope is falling on your knees. Now listen, there's some of you in this room that you've never bowed your knee to Christ, and you've never said, I trust only in you to fix this downward spiral in my life. I would love to talk to you. I'm going to be up here on this stage at the end of this service, and I would love to introduce you to this Jesus who we have hope. Now, Christian, please listen. You have Jesus to fall on. But the same way that we enter into the gospel by surrendering ourselves is the same way that we learn to live in holiness by confessing our sin. Jesus, I can't do this on my own, and I know you love me, and my only hope is in you. So the gospel is how we start this race, right? But it's also how we finish this race and how we can continue living outside of the judgment of God, but in a loving relationship with God. Would you bow your eyes? I want you to wrestle just really quickly. Where are you? Did you kind of forget that sin was a big deal? And the way that God sees it, and the way he sees it, the only way he could pay for it was to send his own son. So if you're not a believer, to come to him. But if you are a believer, would you run to him even stronger, admitting that you can't do it on your own, but he can? Jesus, we need you. Oh, how we need you.